Are you deep in thought, making up answers right now?
I am praying.
Oh, that's good too. All right, let's do this. Hi, friends, and welcome to Sermon Smith. Sermon Smith is a podcast of conversations with church leaders about the craft of sermon preparation. And I am excited today. I always say I'm excited, but I am excited about the people I get to have on here. But this one is a close, dear friend. So I guess that's even a notch above excited, whatever that would be. And with me today is Matt Tebbe. Matt, how you doing?
I'm great. Thanks, John.
Yeah, it's good to see your face.
Yeah.
Nobody else gets to see your face, but I get to see it and hear your voice.
Yeah, it's good to be seen by you. It's good to see your face, too.
So, Matt, why don't you tell us about where you are? Tell us your context, where it is that you do the preaching that you do, and a little bit about that.
I am I'm the pastor of spiritual formation at a about 1,000-person church in northern Indiana. It's in the South Bend, Mishawaka region. We had about 300,000 people in the area, and I've been here for 3 years. It's a church that's largely made up of, the town we live in is about 93% white. And so I am in extremely white context, but also lots of small business owners, lots of blue collar people. There's not much high tech white collar industry in this area. So that gives you a flavor of the context I've been in for the last 3 years.
And what's the church itself? You said it's about 1,000-member church, but is it a new church? Is it a more established church?
Yeah, it's been around for 20 years. About 9 years ago, the founding lead pastor was removed for infidelity, and the church did a search and brought in the pastor that's currently here, and he's been here for the last 9 years. It's a non-denominational church, and I was amazed when I first came here, and I'm still amazed at how many people stuck through the transition from the old regime, if you will, to the new regime. Hmm. So,
and you say you are the pastor of spiritual formations, but I know that you preach fairly regularly. So what does that look like? What kind of rotation is there?
The lead pastor, Rick, preaches probably 60% of the time. I preach about 30, and then other people on staff and even elders will preach the other 10% of the time.
And so you preach about every third week.
Yeah.
What other responsibilities are you carrying beside that?
I oversee counseling ministries at our church. I oversee discipleship ministries, including small groups, study groups. We run some discipleship huddles. We kind of oversee those, beginning to form transition, and then also start some missional communities from remnants of small groups that have begun to see the Lord's calling them more than just caring for each other really well, but to be about extending the gospel in their context. So I oversee those initiatives and plans. And I also create curriculum based around our Sunday service. So when I preach and don't preach, I oversee a discussion guide that we produce for our congregation as well.
So doing spiritual formation, do you find that a lot of your particular preaching has a bent that way? Like, would your preaching tend to be more towards spiritual formation for the congregation than, say, Rick's? Or...
Yes, definitely. And I think probably that my philosophy or my vision of preaching is formed and shaped by that as well. So I see the entire preaching event as a formative experience.
Oh, well, let's just talk more about that. We're already off my outline, but we'll come back to it. So let's talk about the role of preaching as a formative experience. What's your philosophy behind that?
Yeah, I guess to situate myself in where I feel like the Christian culture as I've been raised in. I came up through a philosophy of preaching that leaned heavily on the preaching event as the primary formative experience for the Christian disciple. And so, for instance, in seminary, a third of my classes, if not more, were geared towards being able to exegete the text, being able to translate it from original languages, and then honing and shaping and crafting sermon outlines and sermons. And so I kind of had a healthy dose of preaching is foundational, and the primary vehicle through which people will be formed and shaped to be like Christ. When I hit the ground stumbling in my first church that I became a pastor of while I was in seminary, I realized to my, you know, chagrin that I would preach something one week and explain it as well as I could and give like lots of handles and tags and stories and illustrations. And then the next week, when I would have conversations about what people remembered about it, it was some silly comment I made, or it was some ancillary point, or it was the story I told reminded them of their great aunt who was sick, and so they called them. And it was like I was seeing a disconnect between the information that I was preaching and the formation that was coming out of that preaching event. And so that kind of really shook a little bit of my – at first it shook my confidence in what can preaching accomplish, but that shaking didn't cause my confidence to completely erode, but it actually reformed and reshaped it to be what it is now.
Yeah. And what was that? What was that context? Was that like a part-time ministry while you were in seminary?
Yes, it was. Well, it was a bivocational ministry placement at a church in the northwest suburbs of Chicago. I was a seminary student. I was preaching regularly at this church as well. And then when I graduated, I became a bivocational pastor.
Yeah. So we can, I mean, we can name that, can't we? That was.
That's Life on the Vine.
That was Life on the Vine. And it's worth naming because you were on staff there with Sid Holsklaw. Well, you weren't on staff with Sid, but Sid is who we previously interviewed is at the same church.
Yeah, I was on staff with her husband, and actually when I moved here to Mishawaka, she succeeded me there at Life on the Vine.
And succeeded you in so many ways.
Oh my goodness. I tell you what, John, there are days when, you know, in ministry where you question, did I hear the Lord's voice correctly? Did I do what he wanted me to do? And I think that's normal and natural, but one of the greatest hopes that I draw that I'm where God wants me to be is that church, Life on the Vine, has Sid Holsklaw as a pastor right now. And it's hard for me to imagine them having room or finances for her if I was still there.
Yeah.
She's amazing.
That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Let's get back on the rails. Let's get back on my outline.
Yeah, all right.
That was a fun little foray, and there might be more, but... I think I know the answer to this question, but I don't have the impression that you at the church there go through the lectionary. So how are topics and texts, sermon series and that kind of thing outlined? How far in advance? What kind of role do you play in that?
Yeah, so we do. Well, since I've been here, we've preached through the book of Luke and through the book of 1 Corinthians. And we will do that for a season. The book of Luke lasted almost 10 months. 1 Corinthians, we just finished up at the end of the summer. We typically now in September, beginning of September, we'll do some sort of topical things. We just did a 3-week series on the telos, the point of human existence. And we preached a sermon based out of Genesis, a sermon based in the ministry of Jesus, and then a sermon based in Revelation. We're doing something now called Relatively Speaking, where we're going through the theme of family in Scripture. We're talking about how the family dynamics that we have in our relationships in our biological families, our extended families of church, and the relationship between our parents and the relationship between God as a parent. So we're talking about this, unpacking this metaphor as it relates to all these different relationships we have. Yeah, this past week I preached on singleness and being single as a vocation and a gift. And so these are the kinds of topics we're going to be in until Advent, when we'll go into every year we go into sort of a thematic but canonically oriented series of 4 weeks. And so we kind of function in a hybrid in the sense that we take Advent and Epiphany and Lent, Pentecost rather seriously, and we will pick texts that fit that season, but we do not stay faithful to the lectionary per se.
So you've done two long textual studies in the 3 years you've been there, and then some topical stuff.
Yes.
So, or some thematic stuff might be a better way to say it.
Yes.
So does it tend to be that you'll work through a long one and then you'll take a break and do some thematic stuff? And then, you know, are you guys already charting out next year you'll move toward another deep textual study? Or
yeah, we So the first question is, we will take breaks. So like when we preach through the Gospel of Luke, we lined up Advent texts and Epiphany texts and Lent texts with the theme of Lent being self-emptying and repentance and confession. We picked parables and stories in the Gospel of Luke that had those themes. And so we were not afraid to like jump around a little bit in a text to fit the theme of the church here. And we're also not afraid to take a break. So when we preached the Gospel of Luke, we took a break in the summer. This was the summer previous to this past one, and then picked it up in the fall again. Yeah.
Well, I'm curious then, since you engage really a lot both in, you know, textual preaching versus thematic, I'm wondering how different your process is in preparing for each of those. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about your timeline from when you know, what you're going to be preaching on and when. Like, how does it start? What's the process you work through?
Yeah.
And I'm curious to hear, and I'll circle back and remind you of this question if you don't come back to it, because I'm asking you a two-parter, but how does that vary between what a thematic sermon and a text-driven sermon looks like?
Yeah, so when I get my text, and right now I have my text for the next two times I preach, I'll just begin setting aside 3 to 4 weeks out. I'll try to read the text. I'll try to read the text through. Just read it through. A practice Lectio Divina with the text. And so I just am listening for the voice of the Spirit as I read. I just submit to the text. So the first move for me is to lay my life down in front of the text and to let the text search me and know me. And I feel like I need time for that. And so in the beginning, I'm simply reading it as a Christian, to listen to it as a Christian, not as a pastor, not as a preacher or teacher. And so I feel like that's when I'm most faithful in my preparation. That is my first step in preparing.
Do you feel like you're successful at doing that most of the time? Because that's easy to skip over.
It is easy to skip over. I would say half of the time, mm-hmm. half of the time, I am, yeah. The other half of the time, it'll be a week and a half out, and I'll truncate that. So I'll cram it into like a day or two. So I'll read and sit with the text and listen to it and allow it to do whatever work the Lord is pleased to do in the meager time I give him, and begin to listen to how is this text touching my life right now? What is the Lord bringing to light that I didn't see before? What reality of the kingdom am I sensing him calling me into? And I'll just begin to do that work, and my first step then of preparation isn't just to hear that, but it's to hear that and do something about it. It's to actually live in light of the text, rather than just like learn in light of the text.
Yeah. And so that's typically 3 to 4 weeks out, you start to engage in that.
Yes, on my best day. My best Matt does that.
So you're talking about the text. So I assume right now you're talking about if it's a textual study. What if it's when you're talking about the gift of singleness, where does that begin? Is your first task then to find a text, or how do you do that?
Yeah, I really have a difficult time with thematic sermons. Because I feel much more comfortable as a preacher. A lot of preachers will grab 6 or 7 texts and bring them together and sort of interweave them. And I'm not against using other scriptures to kind of show where this theme or this idea or this pattern shows up. But I really try to preach one text when I preach, and so the thematic thing kind of throws me for a loop. So what I typically do on a thematic thing is, like with the singleness thing, I went to Matthew 19 and 1 Corinthians 7, two places where Jesus and Paul talk about not being married and what that's like. And I just sat in them for a while and asked the Lord, okay, Lord, which one of these do you want me to preach? So even for thematic sermons, I try to anchor them to a text as quickly as possible.
Yeah. So when you know you're going thematic, you're trying to grasp onto a text because that's where your comfort level is. That's what your structure process is.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. I'm kind of the same way. So I struggle with thematic stuff. So I wonder how others do it sometimes.
Yeah, I just I quickly make it into something that I feel comfortable with. This is kind of how I handle it.
Okay, so then you're on your ideal, when you're at your best, Matt, you're 3 to 4 weeks out, you know, and you're sitting in the text as a disciple yourself, what does that process then move on to? What does it look like?
Yeah, well, I allow it to be, so this is, so the metaphor of the text is some sort of picture of God's truth, right? There's a picture, but God's truth is always coming to me, this picture. I'm always seeing this picture through my experience in the beginning. I'm bringing who I am to the text, allowing the text to read me, to identify me, to challenge me, to comfort me, whatever the text wants to do, letting it do that. So I'm really experiencing the text as Matt. The next thing to do is to begin to allow whatever realization, whatever new act of faith the text births in me. It's not just about being smarter, it's about becoming better. And so by better, I mean more integrated, more whole, more less duplicitous, less hypocritical. So I'm being a wise person who's building their house on the rock because I've been sitting with this text and letting it have its way with me. Out of that, I begin to see my world. Right, so the text, which has been a picture and maybe even a mirror showing me who I am, now becomes a window through which I see my world. Begin to see the world through this text, seeing the dynamics of maybe the kingdom of darkness or the kingdom of light at play in this text, the revelation of what this text shows about a kingdom in opposition to God and what this text shows about as a kingdom in faithfulness to God. I begin to notice that about my world. And I begin to make note of that.
Does that come more easily sometimes than others, or do you feel like you just have a standard frame you look through, and this just comes once you start to sit with it?
Yeah, it really. Sometimes I have. It's like wringing a glass of water out of a dry towel. Sometimes it feels like just pulling my teeth to come up with some way. And we can talk more about how I actually structure my sermon. This might make more sense, but. But regularly, normally, I'll begin to see my life through the lens of the text, or looking at the world through the window of the text, and maybe like a color screen in front of a light. Things get colored in that way, and I actually begin to see things. If I've done the proper work, John, of sitting with the text and letting the text have its way with me, I feel like I become the kind of person who is sensitive then to the things that the text has. So it's not like a to-do list or something I have to make myself do, but it's something I become sensitive to, you know, something I begin to notice without having to work at it. But there's no shortcut to that other than letting the text do what it wants to do in me.
So it seems like complementing that, then there has to be some kind of awareness of what is the world that you're trying to see in light of the text. You know, the Bart quote of scripture in one hand and the newspaper in the other.
Yes.
So is that, are there particular practices that you do on a sermon by sermon basis or on an ongoing basis to make you feel like you're staying connected culturally with the culture you want to see the scripture through?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's frequently maybe multiple dynamics in a text, and so it's kind of hard to actually talk about this in the abstract, John. So this past week I was talking about singleness, and singleness is a vocation and calling. And I began to listen to this text and read this text in light of my own experience, and began to think about things like, you know, Jesus says those are those who have been made a eunuch for the sake of the kingdom, you know, and Paul talks about, I wish everybody was like I am, because then you don't have worldly affairs to look after, like a spouse. And I began to just think about my life as a married person and the dynamics at play in movies and in Christian culture that make singleness seem to be not an option, like not a viable, faithful option for a Christian adult. If you're a Christian adult and you're single and you haven't been married, you're at best you're weird and quirky. Hmm. Like at worst, you're somehow a deviant. Or a deficient human, right? And Catholics ship those people off to like nunneries and monasteries. But for Protestants, we got a problem, right? It's okay to be like an old single lady, but it's not okay to be like a 37-year-old man who's never been married. Like that's less okay.
Yeah.
And so, I just began to look at the culture and listen to things. I had some conversations with people. The Lord pricked my imagination about some narratives that were in place at a Christian college I taught in for a while in the Chicago area. And I began to interview some of my friends who went to Christian colleges. And I had immediately all these stories about this incredible pressure that exists in Christian cultures of finding a spouse before you get out of college. Right? This pressure and this elevation of marriage as sort of the only option for somebody who wants to have a fulfilled life.
Yeah.
So that's an example of how it worked this past week. And then you know, we get into more of how I preach. I can share you how that functions in a message. But so I first listen to the text, and what is this text doing? What is this text saying? What world is this text unfurling? And then I began to notice what are the messages, what are the gospels in our world that are in tension or in conflict or with this message, or are parasitic on this message. So they take a kernel of this message and then throw away maybe the nucleus of it. So those kinds of things.
Yeah. So that is really what you just described. Does that mostly come through reflection, or does that involve some study? I mean, do they go, is this before you even really dug in to do some study, or is that all hand in hand?
Yeah, so what'll happen next after I look at my world through this text, in concert with that, I'll begin to listen. So after listening to the text myself, I'll begin to open up my world of listening to the text, and I'll begin to use commentaries. So this is where commentaries come in for me, because I see commentaries not as maybe experts telling me what I should think about the text, but as a conversation partner, as we begin to like just meditate on the text together. So I'll have one or two commentaries that I'm using at any given time, and I will look for other insights or other people's experiences that help them see the text differently than I do, or different tools they're using, whether it's a historical critical method or, you know, a socio-rhetorical method, those kinds of things. And so as that's happening, I'm beginning to see more and more of this world that the text is unfurling, you know, and sometimes what I experience personally is a minor thing in what I proclaim whenever I proclaim that text on a Sunday.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a central thing, but that's kind of it's a symbiotic sort of, it's a developing relationship with the text in the community through commentaries at that point too.
Yeah. And you tend to keep it to just a couple commentaries?
I do. I am a thinker, right? So I could incessantly and forever just read more and more and more about a text. And so for me, this is a personal conviction. I found that my default is to never feel like I'm ready to start crafting a message because I don't have enough data yet.
Yeah.
That's my tendency. And so in order to like discipline that tendency, I usually use at most three. And they have to be really different, right? They have to be extremely different commentaries that give me three different looks at the text. But usually it's one or two.
And so are those your primary tools? Do you spend most of your time in commentaries? Do you do much in the way of word study or anything like that?
I don't pull out my Greek lexicon and pour through it in Chasing Horses. I don't do that. I will, if I'm, I will track down the way words are used, the ways words are translated. If I see a theme emerging, or I think it's an important word, or if I read a commentary and the commentary mentions it, I'll track it down then. But I'm less of a dig in the details kind of preacher, and I'm more in a narrate a world that this text is functioning in kind of preacher. So I'm more of a big picture kind of guy than a detail kind of guy.
Okay. So once you feel like this is starting to coalesce, you know, unfurl, as the word you say, which is, I think we all need to use that word more. It's a great word. But once you feel like this is starting to come together and you've done some of that study that you describe, what's next? How do you start to form this into an actual sermon that you're going to present? How far out are we talking now? Are we talking a week out?
This is a week. Yeah, this is a week, week and a half. This might seem, I try to figure out, what is the text doing? What does the text want to do? What did it want to do in its canonical context, right? So when Jesus said these words to these people, what was he doing? And how do we do that here? So what is the text doing is the first question I say, which is different than what does the text mean, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's different, right? This gets into speech theory and stuff, and I don't want to everybody fall asleep, but the text is doing something. It has a job it wants to do. What was it doing there? And then how do we do that here, right? With changes, right? There's different changes in context. And so when I kind of get a sense of what the text is doing, that gives me sort of the pieces around, like, there's pieces around the text. When Jesus is calling people to faith, he's calling them out of something, out of a posture of, for instance, in Luke 15, right? When he preaches, he preaches on the prodigal son or the, you know, yeah. The forgiving father or whatever. And, that text wants to do something. The Pharisees who are grumbling about the compassion that Jesus has with sinners, Jesus wants the Pharisees to see themselves, to find themselves in that story, and to not stand outside the party, but to come in, right? And so there's a point, there's an intent to that story. And so I then ask, you know, of the world, where are we today? Like, where does God want to do a similar thing today? And what story do I need to tell to help reveal where we are? So, there's people standing outside grumbling because sinners are being welcomed. Where are religious people today upset that insiders don't have the privilege, but outsiders do? And how do I then tell a story that helps reveal where we're living today? That's contrary to the gospel, or in tension with the gospel, or an obstacle to the gospel. So that's my next step, is how do I narrate our experience that helps us get in touch, not just intellectually, but like in our guts, like in our bowels, like connects with us emotionally, that we have a need for the gospel today, right here at 10:25 on Sunday morning in our world, in our lives. This is our need.
And how particular is that?
The story?
Yeah.
Sometimes, so there's a difference between telling a story and telling about a story, right? Good storytellers, it doesn't matter how esoteric or particular, I mean, they could be a quadriplegic skydiver from Tibet, and if they're telling you a story well, you will find yourself in that story, right? So for me, it doesn't, the particular or... To me, the more particular and the more engaged I am in telling a story where people are caught up and grabbed emotionally, the better then that I can unpack that a little more. And I have phrases I use to help people connect themselves who maybe don't feel connected to that.
So this past
Sunday, I told the story of being a Christian college student, hearing administrators say things like, and this actually happened at a Christian college, I want every single man to stand up. This is the first week of class. Every single man to stand up. Now, all the single ladies, I want you to look around, because by the time you leave here, you'll be married to one of these men. Right? Phrases thrown around parachurch ministries like, or from the college I taught at, ring by spring or your money back. There's this incredible pressure on Christian college students to find a spouse before they graduate. Now, not everybody has that experience, right? But I was
especially
trying to...
Especially near blue collar city, right?
Right. But yeah, we do have a Christian college in our city, though. Then a lot of people have experience with it. But around and behind and underneath that pressure is this myth, this romantic myth, right? Of the Jerry Maguire myth, right? You complete me, right? So human contentment and human flourishing come through a relationship with another human, right? City of Angels. Like, Hollywood gets the narratives we live in, and this is why they don't give us sermons. This is why they don't give us speeches. They give us stories, because they realize that stories connect with our gut, and they draw us out of ourselves, and we find ourselves in stories. And so, City of Angels, right, where the angel gives up being an angel to marry a human, and it was all worth it, right, for one kiss, right? This romantic myth of you complete me, and human fulfillment is found in sexual gratification with another person. And so then I was able to unpack this experience of being a Christian college student and say, can we all relate, though, to this draw, this pull of the Jerry Maguire City of Angels? And I told those stories of another person offering the satisfaction, fulfillment, and contentment to making our lives whole and complete, that flourishing lies in this romantic relationship. And I told a couple more little clips to draw people in. Can anyone relate to that? Have you experienced this? Right? and just allow people the space to think and to connect. Right. So I try to start with a particular specific story. It can be funny and humorous. It can be intense. And then unpack that and fold that in and build on-ramps into that experience for people who may not completely line up with that.
So you always start with this, with some story variation like this, because you always want to connect a story to a larger... Like, you want to use that story to connect everyone with where you're intending to go.
Yeah, so I'll start with some sort of... I'll start with... usually I would just read a verse. So this week I read, and there are those who have made themselves eunuch for the sake of the kingdom. Right?
That was your introduction?
Yeah.
Fun.
And I said, today we're going to talk about eunuchs. You know? And a guy actually came up to me afterwards, and his daughter was like... she was in high school. She was like, I thought... We never talked about Unix. He's like, what do you mean? She's like, that's a computer software. And she had no idea what we were talking about. So I usually start with a text, and then I'll give us ears to hear. And so I'll say something like, today we're talking about singleness, and contrary to what we're led to believe and what we had believed in the church and outside the church, human flourishing isn't reserved for the married and the sexually satisfied and fulfilled, but is a birthright of every child of God. The abundant life isn't dependent upon your marital status or your sexual activity. And so then that's where I started to like get people's attention. This is where we're going. This is how we should listen. And then I began telling the story from that of what I think has gotten us to a place where we've made an idol out of Christian marriage.
Hmm. So you start with a story, and then coming out of the story, you say, you really present your thesis, kind of in contrast to the story that you began with.
Yeah, I start with the thesis, John. So Unix text today is about a lot of things. Divorce, I don't have time to talk about that. He holds up marriage, but he also holds up singleness. And Paul does it too in 1 Corinthians 7. And so today we see Paul and Jesus, two celibate single men for their whole life, maybe two of the most fulfilled, satisfied, contented men who've ever lived. We see that. And I actually start up front with my thesis, and then I go into my story. Hmm. So sometimes I'll start with a question, and it won't be the thesis right up front, like to get people whatever. Like I could have started this past week with today Jesus warns us against the idolatry of Christian marriage, just to get everybody like upset and mad and ready to leave, you know. And then I'll start telling a story to kind of unpack that a little bit. So I'll go both ways.
So then what? Yeah. So once you've moved on beyond that, then once you've kind of hooked everybody in and made this, I mean, you're really calling everyone to be present with what you're about to do with the text.
Yes.
You know, I would say.
Yes. Well, this goes back to my observation about preaching that frustrated me. And I realized I was preaching to people's heads, but I wasn't preaching to their hearts. And what I mean by that is I was engaging people in an intellectual activity that allowed truth to remain abstracted from their everyday lives. Hmm. And in doing that, they became smarter, but they didn't become better. And so another way to say that was I was preaching to people with the and I wasn't – this is how – I wouldn't have articulated it like this, but this is the way I was preaching, that their fundamental problem was that they were stupid. And if they could just get smarter, they would become better.
If they would know more.
If they could know more, they would naturally and necessarily do more.
Yeah.
And that's got just enough truth in it to become really, really dangerous if it becomes the entire truth.
Well, and it also can become intoxicating for you because you can be seen as the smart one who's delivering the goods.
Well, John, I don't know if you knew this, but I've mastered divinity.
I've got I've got a
degree to prove it, right? Yeah, I would love it if my authority was based upon my expertise and my competency. What I know and what I can do, right? And what I don't mean obedience, I mean like preach.
Yeah,
but I began to realize that that people don't live from their heads. Right? What we think is important, and it informs what we do. But most people live out of there's a lot of ways to talk about this. Their heart, their emotional programs, what their body believes leads to goodness in life. Right? They live from their wounds. what sin has done to them, their brokenness. They live out of their warped will, right? That's in bondage to different things. And these are all kinds of things that our brain doesn't control, right? Our brain doesn't decide what we're addicted to or what we're in bondage to and what we're not. And so I began to see that in order to preach for transformation, I needed to engage people not just in their minds, but also in their heart, their gut, like grab them by where they live, pull them in. And you can tell, John, you said I like to talk at the beginning, and you weren't lying.
That was before I pressed record.
You're doing a preaching podcast to preachers, and so you'll be lucky to get one more question in.
It's really easy to get preachers to talk. So
I know,
it's like
isn't
the easiest people in the world to interview.
Or insufferable.
So it's the easiest job in the world here.
So, see, now I just kind of, I just sort of thwarted, I just sabotaged my comment, because now I can't remember what I was going to say. It's completely gone. It's completely gone.
Fair enough.
But anyway, I began to preach where people... I know what I was going to say. I mean, there's a difference between people that are entertained and people that are interested and people that are engaged.
Yeah.
There's a body posture change. People breathe differently. People stop blinking as often. People don't fidget. People sit on the edge of their seats. They're everything about them changes when you grab them where they live. Where the spirit has their heart and mind rather than just you're titillating them with information that they didn't know before.
Yeah.
It's the difference between slaking spiritual boredom and proclaiming God's truth into a relationship or experience or personality that really matters.
So then you're taking everything that you're saying here. You know, you've done your best to hook them into this, to make them care about, to engage them, to make them care about what you're about to say.
Yep.
So now you are going to move into text, I assume. So how would you say how you unfold the text for them?
Yeah.
You know, how you exegete really the text for them would be different from exegeting it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, whatever phrase, I come up with a phrase that is kind of I want it to be memorable and meaningful. I want the phrase to be something they remember at lunch. So it has to have some rhetorical punch to it. And for it to be meaningful. So it's not just a slogan. Sounds good, but doesn't mean anything. It needs to have some depth to it. So some punch and some depth. And I'll start with that up front so they know how to listen. I'll repeat that 6 or 7 times throughout my message so that I'll keep coming back to this one big idea. And I state the big idea up front, and then I'll say, let's look at, you know, Matthew 19. Now, let's see what Jesus is doing here. Let's see how he responds to his disciples, right? And so then I'll walk through the text, and I'll give the necessary background for us to understand what Jesus was doing. And I'll give us the necessary, I'll say, notice this and notice this. I'll give comments on what we should see and how Jesus does it. And then I'll begin to say, then I'll begin to like do an inquiry with the congregation. So what would it look like then? If Jesus were here today, how would he be doing the same thing? And I won't use those words, but that's kind of the posture. And then I'll begin making, so the comment on the text, I probably would fail a lot of preaching classes. I don't exhaust everything in the text. I don't preach everything that's there. And I will sometimes say, hey, this idea right here could take a whole sermon. That's not my sermon today. Right? This thing right here that he mentions is amazing. And there's like 16 things to say, and I have time to say one of them. And the only reason I'm saying this is because it serves this big idea that I'm proclaiming today. So I will tell people, hey, listen, I'm not preaching this today. This is here, but this doesn't serve what we're doing. So I really try to stay laser focused when I walk through the text.
So, which astute listeners might recognize that what you're describing is very similar to what Sid Holzclaw described, because, excuse me, because it's a structure that I know that was used at Life on the Vine.
Yeah.
Do you feel like as you've, in this new place that you are, so I assume that you first started to develop and learn and implement a lot of this there. Do you feel like you've changed in any way of how you do this, developed it further, or had to modify it for the context you're in now, being a different setting?
Yes, I would say that I teach more in this setting than I did at Life on the Vine.
And why is that?
Because I'm finding that the spiritual understanding of basic concepts isn't as robust and mature. So, at Life on the Vine, I could get away with mentioning concepts and ideas that I could assume most people had background and some basic knowledge of. And at River Valley, where I am now, I find that if I do that, a majority of the people they'll kind of shut down. They won't wrestle with, I don't understand that. They'll just be like, oh, now he's talking about something on, I have no idea what he's doing.
Now he's talking about the Unix operating system.
Right. And so, and I'm a DOS man, so I don't know. So there's a sense in which I need to not assume as much. But this explaining idea, I try to explain as little as possible in my sermons. And I'd rather narrate and proclaim than explain. Because explanation appeals to rational cognitive thinking, which, again, I'll say this again just because I don't want people to hear what I'm not saying, is necessary and important. But things like narration and proclamation also include the cognitive rational mind, but more typically will engage the heart, the bowels of a person as well.
Yeah.
So there's sometimes I will explain, but I think when I see Jesus proclaiming truth in Scripture, I see the people who didn't really want to follow him asking for explanations. I see his disciples doing this too, and he explains like the parable of the seeds, right? But more often than that, he just re-proclaims something to them. Like Jesus doesn't like exhaustively explain exactly how he's doing everything. He just re-proclaims something that provokes him again, and then he proclaims something again, and then they ask him a question. He asks them a question. So I really would love, I don't mean this to sound pompous. I'd love to preach like Jesus did, in the sense of provoking people to a response, getting people on the cusp of the kingdom, so they have to do something first. Right before they've answered every question they have about it.
And so I assume then, you know, as we're working through the structure, what you just described is how you try to wrap it up.
Yeah.
What does that look like?
Yeah. So I never give people three ways to apply a sermon, ever.
It's always two or four?
It's always 16 things, because most Christians don't have enough stuff that they've tried to do and feel bad about for not doing. So I try to give them more. No, I never give prescriptive responses. So one of my primary assumptions in the proclamation of the word is that the birthright of every child of God is to hear the voice of their father. And the Spirit wants to speak to the church and to the churches, but to our church today. And so our church, we hopefully train them to help them listen to the Spirit of God in the proclamation. What is God drawing your attention to? What is he pointing at? Right? What relationship right now, or situation, or past sin, or future possibility, what picture or image or word, what's making you uncomfortable or excited or nervous or hopeful right now? And let's just tend to that. And that's different for every person.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I start with a narration of a very particular situation or person, and the rest of the message is spreading the boundaries of that story to include all of us. And so then the response, like, and this is where my preaching has developed, John. So I used to preach for understanding and information transfer. If you could regurgitate and explain to me what I explained to you, that was a successful sermon. Now I preach for response. Right? So how are you a different person leaving than you were coming? You've encountered the living God in Jesus Christ. And so there's been some consent of the will, some action, some surrender, some thanksgiving, some lament, some praise, some affirmation of truth, right? That you've done in response to God's truth held out to you. And that's different for everybody. And I mean, I have the spiritual gift of over answering questions, but I'm not even sure I answered that question. Did I answer your question?
No, I think you did. I think you did. I mean, I think the image of spreading out your initial story to include everyone is it's a great image. I mean, I can put that in my head as you're saying it. So
yeah.
But we're pushing time-wise here from what I try to do. And because I have another meeting here in a little while, but a couple questions I have for you. One of them being, you know, this is something that this process you go through is something for preaching every 3 weeks on average. Do you think it would be sustainable for you to try to have this same process of sermon development if you preached 3 weekends out of 4, or what do you think you might have to tweak?
Yeah, I think I would jump off a roof before I preached every 3 weekends out of 4. So, I mean, there needs to be multiple communicators in every church, because in our celebrity-driven consumeristic culture, if you have 6 people in your church, 5 of them will think you're the celebrity. And so I don't know why you'd want to preach 3 out of 4 weekends, but that doesn't answer your question. I did preach much more frequently at Life on the Vine than I do here. And it was sustainable. What I've realized as a preacher is, what I've realized as a human is that I'm a control freak. And the better I am at something, the more control I want over it. And so, what I've found is that in my competencies, I'm most tempted to rely on my flesh to make things happen and get things done. And so the discipline of approaching a text like this, where it's listening and noticing and tracking and tending to what God is doing as a primary foundation for what the shape the sermon takes, is that it's out of my control. It's out of my control. Hmm. Thursday afternoon, if I'm still like, how am I going to narrate this? I will go online and like begin talking, and you know, I'm having conversations. It's not a passive thing, but it's not a mechanistic thing either. It's not a,
yeah.
So, no, I did it much more frequent Life on the Vine, and it actually increased my faith a great deal in that God cares much more for my sermon than I do.
This probably oversimplifies it, but hearing you describe your process, which I think probably comes into play with the question I just asked about sustainability, is it feels like your process is even more about attention than it is about time. So it's more about you. You have to put the time in for sure.
Yeah.
But it's about being able to be attentive, you know, to what's the text that you're reflecting on, what's the story, and those things come to you at different times.
Yes, it does. Yeah, that's great. So my best sermon prep doesn't happen in my laptop in my study.
Yeah.
It happens as the text has gotten into me, and I begin to process and experience and filter life through it. And life isn't lived in the study. It's lived hospital beds and changing your 5-year-old sheets because he wet the bed, and giving your wife a back rub. You know, those are the moments of life. So
a few real practical questions, and we'll pull it all together. What do as you're capturing all of these thoughts and ideas? I mean, you just scribble all this in a notebook of some kind? Is this all on a computer? Are you digital? Are you analog?
Yeah, I'm pretty digital. I used to write stuff, but now I got an iPhone and I use a notes app, and I will, like, phrases will pop in my head. A way to say things will pop in my head, and I'll just type it in. And so I take notes a lot on my phone.
Just write in the notes app.
Yep. Write in the notes app.
And then when it's time to pull it all together, you go into the notes app and see what all you've captured in there.
Yeah, I'll look at that. Sometimes I'm a big, like, the spirit, like the muse will hit me, and I'll be doing something else, and I'll just get this. I feel like a revelation almost, like an image or a picture or a story or a way to say something or a way to explain something, and I'll just have to write it down. I have to get it out, and so sometimes I do that too.
Yeah, and so then from there, from wherever you've captured it, do you develop most of the rest of this in Microsoft Word? Do you use anything else?
Yeah, I use Pages.
Pages.
Yeah, I'm kind of a snob. So I'll use Pages, and I just use Pages. I'll type up a manuscript, but I don't use it when I preach. So I'm a verbal. This has been something too that's maybe, I don't know if helpful. I'm a verbal processor, John. Like,
I do know that.
Yes, and I need to talk things out to know A, if I believe them. and B, how I believe them, and C, how I need to say them, and D, how I shouldn't say them. So I will take like a bare bones manuscript and begin talking it out like I'm talking to you. And in doing that, I figure out what I don't need to say, and I figure out how to say what I do need to say. And so from the manuscript, usually on Monday, to the sermon on Sunday, I'd say it's about 50% the same. And it's not that I haven't memorized the text that I've typed, but it's just been internalized to the point where I preach without notes, I preach just with my Bible, and I'm able to talk like I'm having a conversation about a text to a group of people I love. And if I've done my work, if I can't remember my sermon, I shouldn't expect the people who hear it to remember it either.
Yeah, yeah. So what do you end up taking nothing up there with you other than a Bible?
Yeah, just a Bible.
Yeah.
I'm to the point where I first did that about 5 or 6 years ago, and I was scared to death, and I literally memorized every word of my manuscript and revised my manuscript 15 times. And now I will print off the manuscript Monday, talk it through Tuesday, talk it through Thursday, think it through, pray it through Saturday, and be able to preach it Sunday, and it's not a train wreck. So
how often have you afterwards said, "Oh, I completely forgot to say such and such"?
Yeah, you know, as many, and here's the thing, like, this is the trust and the control thing. As many things as I forget to say in the moment, because I feel like there's this balance between faithfulness and between like spontaneity, you know, like preparation and spontaneity. I feel like the Lord is able to work in the loose. He's teaching me how he can work in the looseness of my delivery. So because I don't have a stranglehold on this manuscript, he's able to surprise me with illustrations or stories or metaphors or ways to say things or questions to ask that I had no idea I would say, you know? Mm-hmm. So I do forget some things. Okay, I mean, it doesn't happen to the point where I feel like, man, I should have brought up a manuscript. But more often than forgetting things, I'm able to, I feel like there's revelation that happens, and things that come to me or given to me that I didn't prepare for.
It seems like you're, two more very practical questions related to all this. It seems like your process is fairly ephemeral, meaning everything that you're pulling together is temporary for this sermon alone.
Yes.
Because you have everything projected out for you. Do you have any sort of process of, even as you're reading other books? Because one thing I know from conversations with you, you're always pretty quick to say, this is what I'm learning right now.
Yeah.
You know, which I assume finds its way naturally into sermons. But do you have any kind of process where you are always, where you're just collecting ideas for down the road?
Yeah. I was listening to a podcast today. I try to listen to different podcasts as I drive. And this podcast was on blood. And they were talking about an artist who did an art exhibit on HIV-infected blood. And I'm thinking in my head, if I had time, I would blog about this and make it this about fear and reaction to things we don't understand. And so everything I listen to, I'm trying to like internalize it. I'm really, really bad at having a file cabinet with tabs and folders for sermon illustrations. I'm better at thinking deeply and well about what's right before me right now, and allowing it to either I write about it in my blog, or I'll just kind of file it away in my heart, and letting the Lord bring those things to mind as I need them. I mean, maybe that's I could be more disciplined about that, but that's the way I've functioned so far.
So tell me about some go-to resources for you, books that you feel like are helpful, not only in your preparation, but in terms of have formed how you preach or formed you. And you just mentioned podcasts. So if there's a few podcasts you think are helpful.
Yeah. Well, I used to think I was a horrible storyteller. I remember being in preaching class, and I really could explain things well, and I could illustrate things well, but telling stories I was bad at. There's a couple of podcasts that I've listened to that have really helped me learn how to pace and tell a story, how to draw people in and tell a story. And I get these on iTunes downloads. One is The Moth.
Yeah.
You know, I don't endorse every Moth story, right? Because It's not a Christian podcast for Christians. It's a human
experience.
Podcast.
I think you can endorse that it's human experience.
It's human experience. So The Moth is good. Also, Radio Lab is really good. They take a topic, blame, blood, space, and they tell stories about it on a radio format that's fairly unique anymore. And again, they talk about scientific things and music things and nature things, but the way they tell stories is really good. The way that they build tension, the way that they hold you to a climax, the way that they resolve things, the way that they ask questions, super, super good. And I'm not taking notes on that, but I'm just allowing my character to be formed and shaped, and then I find that I naturally imitate what I give myself to.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So those are ways I've learned how to tell stories. I try to listen to preachers that I think are really good. Early on in my preaching, I would listen to guys like Chuck Swindoll and a couple other older kind of like Christian stalwarts, and I found myself not being able to imitate them very well. I didn't connect with them. I love their preaching. I didn't connect with them. Early on then, as a preacher, back when I was a junior high youth pastor, people like Rob Bell, I really connected with. I felt like he did a great job of making people curious about what he was talking about. He's an excellent teacher in that way. So I try to find people that were good, better at what I did than I was, and give myself over to them. And there's a couple more today. I don't know if you want me to...
Sure. Why not?
So Jonathan Martin is a pastor. He's on Twitter, Renovatus Pastor. He just wrote a book called Prototype. He's a Pentecostal pastor from North Carolina. He's great to listen to. I enjoy listening to him.
Have you read his book as well?
I have read Prototype.
Good stuff.
It's excellent. Okay. Yeah, it's excellent. So I try to listen to people that preach better than I can preach and learn from how they do that. In terms of books on how... On preaching, the only thing that comes to mind, John, is Brueggemann has written some books. Walter Brueggemann has written some books on preaching that I think have been formative to understand what the proclamation event is about.
What would those be? Top of your head? You can email them to me and I can add them.
Yeah, I'll email them.
Prophetic imagination?
Yeah, the prophetic imagination is one. I mean, they're over here on my bookshelf behind the picture that Dave Fitch sent me of himself. And so I have to move that. And he'd be the one blocking. So I'll have to look at those up and maybe we can add them on.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's great. So he would be your primary influencer for that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, the big idea, this idea of a big idea, I mean, this is Haddon Robinson all the way, right? The big idea sermon. He's kind of the grandfather of expository preaching. Like one idea.
Yeah.
One idea that you're proclaiming, not six, not four ideas with six subpoints, not 16 points on one thing. It's just a big idea, and you support that as many ways as possible. So he's had a good, big influence on me.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, or Matt, I have no idea where Jeff just came from. My good friend Matt Tebbe, let me just call you the wrong name. Thanks so much. It's beautiful to have you on here.
Yeah, thanks, John.
And, I had no question that you would have many good things to say, and all I had to do was ask two or three questions and get you going. So,
yeah.
It's been a blessing. So, thank you. And for somebody who wants to find you online, Twitter, your blog, podcast for your church, if they want to hear maybe the singleness sermon you talked about, can you give us links for all that?
Yeah, rivervalley.net is our website at the church, and our sermons are on there. There's a way to listen on our website. My blog is my name, matttebbe.com, MA3TSEBBE.com, and my Twitter is my name, Matt Tebbe, MA3TSEBBE, MATTTEBBE.
You have the benefit of having a name that's unique enough to be able to get it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's nice.
All right. Well, thanks, man.
Yeah, John.
Great to talk
to you. My pleasure.
Yep. Blessings.